for Lori too, like it made sense that she wasn't around all the time and that you sort of grew to care about her and not have her shoved down your throat, because it made the impact of what happens to her that much more meaningful and powerful.
That thing of like knowing the character is vibrant and knowing that there is dimensions and layers and depth to it, but waiting for the moment for it to be unleashed, right?
Welcome to Trade Secrets, an HBO Max podcast where you get to listen in on an intimate and unexpected conversation between two great storytellers. Trade Secrets brings together actors, writers, directors, and other creative pros to discuss their work, process, and passions. And we also make room for the surprises that come from chatting about everyday human experiences, too. We're talking quirky obsessions, culinary adventures, whatever it is that our guests want to explore. Today's conversation features actors from two television shows that have made a huge impact on the culture this year, I May Destroy You and Mayor of Easttown. Papa Esiedu joins from his flat in London, and Julianne Nicholson from her home in Los Angeles. Both Papa and Julianne are nominated for Best Supporting Actor Emmys for the first time this year. In this chat, they get into the function of side characters in narrative storytelling using the Duolingo app and the differences between New York City in movies and in reality. And without further ado, please enjoy Papa and Julianne.
Hey, Julia, what's up? How you doing?
Papa, how's it going? I'm happy to see you.
It's so nice to see you. Are you well?
I feel a little nervous, but good.
Where are you right now?
I'm in Topanga Canyon in Los Angeles.
Is it sunny there?
It's sunny. It's very beautiful. It's basically like the countryside dropped into a city.
I hate that for you.
It's pretty hard. It's a hard life.
I love that for you. Yeah.
Where are you?
I'm in London, and
London, which has like the best weather ever.
Yeah, look, it's the 9th of August. It's the middle of summer. I haven't seen the sunshine for a week, maybe. It's been raining constantly, you know.
Do you have plans to come to LA? Do you want to come to LA?
Yeah, you know what? I kind of feel like, you know, there was this, you know, there was this thing, pilot season's not really a thing or as much as it once was kind of thing. I remember Brits, we used to like come en masse to LA in like kind of like January, February.
And take all our jobs.
Trying to take your jobs.
I'm kidding. Right?
But like, you think that was about us trying to like, you know, you think that was like economic migration, looking for jobs. It was really just like us running away from like the harsh winter here.
Yeah.
Honestly,
no,
it was like
it.
A holiday. So
I get it.
I'd be happy to do that.
Okay. I know, if only pilot season existed anymore.
Exactly. Exactly. Anyway, look, this is so exciting. I am so excited to be able to talk to you right now. I'm just like such a huge fan. It's actually like embarrassing. I kind of can't really look at my computer screen right now. Every time I look at you, I'm like, oh my God, it's her. She's there. I can't believe it.
Oh no, but that's so nice. I mean, I thank you. And I loved your show too. And I thought you did such beautiful, beautiful, moving, surprising, grounded work on it. So I was very excited that it was you that I would be talking with today also.
So like, has it been something that you've always wanted to do? Have you always wanted to be an actor?
No, I actually didn't start, you know, officially acting until I was 24, actually.
Oh, wow.
I wanted to when I was a little kid, but where I grew up, there was just no avenues to that. I guess when I was in high school, I was, you know, that was the dream. And I had this idea that I would like get myself to New York.
Sure.
And that would be closer to acting. I moved to New York when I was 18 and I would take classes. I would like seek out classes, but none of them really made sense to me or felt like I just was searching for like what, for a feeling. I didn't know what it was, but I was like searching for the thing that would make sense and feel like, yes, this is, I can commit to this. And then when I was 24, I met this teacher who it suddenly all sort of dropped in and I was like, oh, okay. And after working with her for a couple of years, I met a manager who took me on like a Will C because I worked with one of her other clients in a restaurant and my boyfriend at the time knew her. So she said, all right, let's try this. And then in New York in the 90s, you could get small parts in small movies. Like their independent movies were actually independent movies and you could like, you know, needle your way in. And so I got a few of those and then jobs. Luckily I kept working and here I am.
Wow, awesome. So it was kind of like a thing, like, talk me through, so like, did you kind of grow up near New York or?
I grew up outside of Boston.
Outside of Boston.
So first of all, I always dreamed about New York from all those like 80s movies where they showed New York, like Tootsie, which is my favorite movie. Like that bustle of people down the sidewalks and the yellow taxis. It just felt like there was such a life happening there.
Yeah, same.
And I did a little bit of modeling when I was in high school. And so I would go to New York for some jobs every now and again. And right. I just felt like, the first time I went, I got a pounding headache. But then after that, it was just felt like, it just felt so exciting to be there. And so I wanted to get there. And for me, it just felt, and also I guess maybe it was Tootsie all these years later. Like, you know, the acting, the auditions, like that felt like the cooler, easier sort of just practically place for me to get than Hollywood, which just felt like, that just felt too sort of far away.
Yeah, I really relate to that feeling of being a kid and thinking of New York as this like otherworldly kind of like dreams can come true type place.
Yeah. Have you spent much time there?
Yeah. One of my aunties is like a proper, like she's from the Bronx. She lives in the Bronx. So I remember like watching Home Alone 2 and like Macaulay Culkin spends like the whole time in the Four Seasons. So that was kind of like my idea of what New York was like. Thinking, oh, New York is just like so quaint and it's always snowing and, you know, beautiful. And I remember going to meet my auntie for like 2 weeks in the summer of, it must have been like 2001, maybe 2000 or 2001. It was so hot. It was like one of those summers where there was a blackout. The whole city blacked out because it was so hot. People were like crying in the street kind of thing. I was like, what is this hell? You know? But yeah, since I've been like lucky to go a few times and work there, etc. And it's a kind of wonderful place to be an actor, isn't it?
Yeah. I feel really grateful that that's where I started actually.
Yeah.
I love it in the summers. I know it's disgusting with heat, but like when I lived there, people would leave in the summers because they would go to the other, and I never had a place anywhere else. So the city would be deserted and people just sort of like slink around the city and like very little clothing and go sit outside and drink wine and have food. And I loved it. It's different now. With kids, it's a different experience. Now you're just like schlepping and sweating and like not cute. But it's pretty great place to arrive to.
It's got a kind of European feel to it as far as American cities go, right?
Definitely. But I moved there with a modeling agency and then I would like take classes and things. But then I went to school at Hunter College. I was a waitress. I just was sort of like living my life there because I just fell in love with the city.
Sure.
And then when I was 24, I started taking classes and then started working, you know, auditioning, working a little bit and still waitressing for a few years before I made any money.
Yeah. Like I love the idea of taking classes. That to me is like a very American kind of thing. Cause obviously here in the UK, a lot of us kind of get into this industry via different routes, but like often through, you know, theatre school or drama school.
Yeah.
You know, so I went through drama school, which was like 3 years of very embarrassing, very bad like impressions of like various animals at the zoo or whatever, you know? That was our kind of like gateway into what was meant to be acting. And we were like, how do you marry the two? How do you marry these like great movies or great plays?
Yeah.
So like we go for 3 years, then you graduate and then you have to go and work. And the idea is that that's the end of your education, which obviously doesn't make any sense, right? Because what do you know after 3 years? What do you know after 10 years? What do you know? Like the thing is ongoing, right? And I feel like in America, there's way less ego in the fact that actors who have been working for 10 years or whatever will still go to class and still, you know, continue developing their craft. Whereas we're like, we graduated from so-and-so 10 years ago, so I know what I know and that's it.
Right. Now I feel like my every job is like lessons.
Yeah.
You know?
Did you ever do plays?
I did my first play when I was 28 and then I could never get cast in plays. And then it started making me feel like such shit that I was like, no more plays. I also didn't like plays for a while. Then I went to see Cherry Jones in Pride's Crossing when I was like 26. And just, she plays like a girl from age 7 to 80 and she just blew me away. And I was like, oh, maybe there's something to this theater thing. But now I love going to the theater. I also watched some clips of your Hamlet, which was beautiful.
Oh, wow.
I'm sorry I didn't get to see it in person.
I didn't grow up like acting. I didn't grow up wanting to be an actor necessarily. I didn't really know what that was.
You're really a doctor.
I wanted to be a doctor. Did you know
that? I did my homework.
Yeah, I was going to be a doctor. I think like anyone who really wants to be a doctor is really just like, it's really an ego trip, isn't it? You just want to save people's lives and have people shake your hands afterwards, don't you?
Right. And now it's same, I mean, same diff. No?
Yes, really? But yeah, I came to it very late and, you know, had a big kind of complex people going to drama school. Loads of these people have been like doing jobs since they were like 8 years old or 7 years old or whatever. I'd never been in a play before I'd gone to drama school. I'd actually only been to the theatre for the first time when I was like 18 or something. So I definitely had a complex about other people knowing more than me and being able to do it with more ease or more confidence than I could. And so I kind of made quite a concerted decision to do plays, to start off in the theatre, because it just meant that I could just watch people, you know? Mm. It was like I could just like watch other people for like, you know, a 3 month run or a 6 month run. And I was lucky to kind of like work in big kind of established theatre, like the National Theatre here or the Royal Shakespeare Company, and like watch like really kind of heavyweight actors doing it night after night after night. And that kind of like gave me a little, you know, peek hole into what this thing that we're kind of searching for is, because it's so intangible, isn't it? It's so kind of elusive, and we have words like truth and authenticity and spontaneity and all of that. But like at the end of the day, what we're kind of looking for, it's very difficult and almost impossible to describe, and definitely to teach.
To do even.
And probably to do, right? So I think that's why, at least at that point in my career, I was way more orientated towards theatre, because it gave me an opportunity to steal other people's ideas.
Was there anyone in particular that stood out to you, like, I'd like to do that?
Sure.
Was there anyone in particular that felt like something to strive for you?
I remember I watched, I think it came to New York, the Mark Rylance, who's obviously like now a very famous actor, but like up until 5 years ago was kind of really only famous in the theatre community here. He did a show called Jerusalem.
I watched it.
Did you see it in New York?
Yes.
Of course, right. Yeah.
It's amazing. And Mark Rylance is one of the best ever, period.
Right. And it's so brilliant that he's getting that recognition now. But like, he was like a real kind of like the equivalent of like an indie movie star, whatever, you know, like he was just doing plays, and he was doing weird plays as well. And like, this play is set in like the West Country of England in the forest, with like an older guy around like all these like young, like teenagers
urchins
drinking, yeah, and all of that. Like, there was something so physical and soulful and just huge about like what he managed to tap into for that show.
I agree.
And again, it's very difficult to explain what it was, because yeah, it was funny, and yeah, it was moving, and yeah, it was, you know, impressive, but it's none of those things that I'm actually talking about. There was something that kind of like keyed in to something on a more fundamental DNA level, which I was like, wow, this is something that we can do as performers. We can, you know, get to that place. So I was like, that's something that I want to learn how to do.
Yeah. I feel like when that happens, it's actually like a little bit of magic being sprinkled on. Like, you can do all the work, but when it works to that level, it's something, as you say, it's unexplainable. You can't find words for it.
Yeah. And that isn't that the terrifying thing? The fact that like you almost can't do it on purpose. You've just got to hope that it happens.
It's there. Yeah, it is terrifying.
How can anyone sleep at night, right? Speaking of huge performances and very moving, significant projects, I think we've got to talk about Mayor of Easttown, which is probably the biggest show this year, watched by so many people across the globe in this country and in America. What a show. What an amazing thing to have been a part of. Do you remember the day that, or the evening that the script came into your inbox or got sent to you or whatever? Do you remember that and what it felt like?
Yes. My agent said, Kate wants to chat. Oh. I've known her for a long time. And she said that she was doing this show and that she wanted me to read the scripts and how amazing it was going to be and how I had to do it. And I was very excited because I think she's so good. I thought it'd be fun to be able to play her best friend. And then I read the scripts. And actually the first couple, I thought, yes, the scripts are amazing, but like, where the fuck is Laurie? Like, why am I going to do this? But they assured me, I felt that part is something that between you and I felt that sometimes while we were filming too, like, what am I doing here? I'm just here to like pass her a beer. What's going on? And then I, you know, I love the scripts. I love Kate. I love Brad Inglesby, who wrote the show. And I was like, yeah, HBO. Of course. I'm going to say yes. And now it's like, thank God I did. And making it was revealing and just how sort of we all like landed in these people and in this place in a pretty deep way. And in hindsight, I realized like Brad so knew what he was doing. Of course, like across the board he did. But for Lori too, like it made sense that she wasn't around all the time and that you sort of grew to care about her and not have her shoved down your throat because it made the impact of what happens to her that much more meaningful and powerful.
I feel like I actually understand what you're talking about in such a real way of that thing of like knowing the character is vibrant and knowing that there is dimensions and layers and depth to it, but waiting for the moment for it to be unleashed, right?
Yeah.
So in those moments where like it feels like you're kind of just like passing a beer or having a conversation that doesn't feel like it's at the heart of the dramatic heft
yes,
of like what's
yes.
happening at the time. As an actor, how do you approach those moments? How do you like still commit with the same kind of fervor as you do when you're like at the center of it all? And
really, I think those are the harder scenes for me, like without a doubt, like to ground those in like any sort of realism or truth, as you say, like our words, our actor words, but those are as important scenes, as equally important as the like major blow up scenes. But I find those to be the harder ones to feel good about, to feel like, yeah, that was true. That felt like not forced or like I was that person, or I find it really challenging. I mean, you go through such an amazing arc in your show, which I just also blew me away. I May Destroy You just was like so original and brave and moving. And I mean, also like blew everyone's socks off. It was so exciting to watch it be like, this is out there. This is out there now. Yay! So good.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I definitely, I thank you for saying all those kind things. I really, really relate to it. And I think the kind of real artist inside me says that, yeah, it's just like really important and you need to provide counterpoint and you need to see the totality of a character's journey. And sometimes it's exciting and sometimes it's domestic or whatever. But like the, you know, the gremlin inside me is like, what the fuck am I supposed to do with this bit? Or why is my character not giving his two cents on it? You know, like it's kind of juvenile, right?
No, I don't think so. It makes sense. Of course. Like you have stuff you want, you have stories you want to tell. So, yeah. But do you see now having watched it, or do you feel like you can be open to that being as important as the, because actually you have to set up the whole world as like a real world. And so if people are just having, you know, blow ups or revealing deep truths every scene, no one cares.
100%.
You have to have those like throwaway moments.
It's like a tapestry, right? It's a tapestry with like many different kind of threads that go through it. And I definitely see it in retrospect. And I'm really grateful for it because in those moments, that's when you've got to have trust, like you say, in the writer, or you've got to have trust in the showrunner, the director, whatever, to have like an idea of like being able to spin all the plates to the right speed at the right time. Whereas as an actor, sometimes you can get so caught in the plate being spun as hard as possible that yeah. you kind of lose sight of that. So I definitely do get that. And I think that's what makes some of these characters so wonderful. And sometimes you actually can tell more of the story in those like quieter, smaller, less kind of sensational moments. You can tell more about character in those moments than in the big blow-up moments. But I mean, your character goes on such a emotional roller coaster, and particularly towards, you know, the end of the series in those like final two episodes, really kind of has some challenges that she has to face.
Yeah.
You've definitely got some scenes with Kate's character, with your son, where like you really have to go there, and you go all the way in, right? So how did you approach it on those days? Were those days difficult, tough for you? Or are you one of those people who's like, just keep rolling till you get it? Or do you just kind of like leave it?
The stakes are so high for Lori that you have to commit to that. Otherwise, the whole thing's for naught. Those stakes, you can't get higher.
Yeah. So how did that work? Where did the pandemic strike in terms of your shooting schedules?
We had filmed for like 4 months and then shut down for 6 months and then came back for a couple of months.
I mean, it's a dumb question to say, was that discombobulating or did you?
Yeah, it was weird, but I felt like we didn't put it down. I never put it down entirely, like while we were away. And I was like, oh my God, this stupid hair. I just wanted to get a haircut. But I was like, I can't cut my hair. What about you? Did you work during the pandemic?
Yeah. So we were so lucky with I May Destroy You that we finished we kind of finished shooting it at the end of January.
Whoa.
In 2020.
Yeah.
So we were doing all of our post in the middle of the pandemic. And that was a real moment where when we were like, how are we? Because, you know, like when we were doing like ADR, for example, which when you have to like redub over all your lines, all the studios were shut. So
did you use that microphone you're using right now?
I wish I had this microphone. I got sent like the most budget version of this microphone. No. And I was in my girlfriend's like cupboard with a duvet over my head,
blankets like over
trying
your head.
To like, yeah. balance like the script and my laptop and the microphone, you know? Oh, so no. Like it was a real DIY process that we had to go through in post. We were like, we've got to do like 12 episodes of post in a pandemic when we haven't got any of the equipment to do it properly. Like a lot of the show is shot on location and shot outdoors. So like in terms of like audio, that's not
wind,
great.
Cars,
you know, it's
right.
not great. And shooting in the middle of London, it's like,
yeah.
It's not exactly a clean audio slate, you know? So we do have a lot to do, but it's a real example of like, if you really want to get it done, you're going to get it done, you know? Yeah.
Have anything that you do when you end a job to like leave that character behind to re-enter your life?
I'm not really a fan of just like saying okay goodbye and just like letting it and just like not kind of I kind of try to make something of like the end of a show because like often it's like several months of yourself, not even just your time, but like yourself, your family's time, your friend's time that you've kind of put into something.
Yeah.
So it's got to be meaningful. So I think it's important to respect that and just say that, look, like this meant this to me and I enjoyed it for this reason. And, you know, it was difficult for this reason. But like, I suppose that's why it's sometimes like amazing to be in shows like what we're talking about now, because like you shoot them like years ago and you kind of, when you're making them, you're not thinking about, oh, am I still going to be talking about this in like a year's time or 2 years time? Or is someone going to give a about like what I was thinking in that scene or whatever? You're never thinking that at the time.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of beautiful thing about some of these shows, that it gives you an opportunity to kind of properly reflect and like actualize some of those experiences. So I try and do that as much as possible. And I wish I could say that I go on holiday after every time I do a job, but I'm too scared it's going to be the last job that I ever do. So I always say yes immediately to another one. And that's why I've aged like 40 years in the last 40 weeks.
No, I don't think that's just your own perception.
Yeah. How about you?
I agree with having a little grief or a little parting, you know, to say goodbye to something, to the process, to the character, to the people that you've spent time with. I feel like if it means that much to you while you're doing it, it'd be hard to not have a moment of that. And that sort of, there are degrees of that depending on the job and what it entailed really. But I have to say, like having a family, it's so full that I don't have much. I can't give much to the other anymore in terms of like the come down. It's like I come home and it's time to like make dinner. So I do.
What's your kind of signature dish? What kind of things do you bring to the family dinner table?
I would say, well, we have what my kids around here call the good chicken, which is basically chicken that's been marinating for a long time in like fish sauce, soy sauce, sugar, ginger, garlic. There's that. Spaghetti and meatballs.
Salivating over here.
Well, I'll make you meatballs when you come.
Hey, I'm excited. It's that in itself is a reason for the American immigration system to give me a visa.
Okay.
what do you do when you're like not acting? Like, how do you like get away from all of this like psychosis and neurosis? And
I started playing piano. I started taking piano lessons.
Oh, wow.
I was doing a job and the director called me or texted like 2 weeks before and was like, hey, do you play piano? I was like, hey, no, I don't at all. And he's like, oh, don't worry. We'll fudge it. And I was like, no, I don't want to be those actors where they show the hands doing everything. And then they're like, then it's like cut to the close up of me, like, you know, playing piano. And so we have a music teacher and my son has been taking piano and my daughter plays guitar. And I was like, can you just teach me this one song? And so she taught me Fur Elise, a very simplified version so I could play it in the movie. And then I was like, this is lovely. And so I kept with it.
I'm just like so impatient. Like I just got back from holiday in Spain and I was on Duolingo trying to teach myself Spanish.
How'd that go?
Look, I love it. I love it. I love it. But like the thing of like being great on Duolingo and then being face to face with someone and like trying to speak their language and how quickly they're just like speak English to me.
Yes, is, like, I had so the crushing. Same thing. Like you are such and such percent fluent.
Yeah, 2%.
Oh, okay. Then, yeah.
Apparently you're better than me, are you?
Instead, I was like 48% fluent, which I knew was an exaggeration. But then once I was trying to order a gelato, it was like all over. I was in Buenos Aires and it was like, no, I can't.
Next time we do one of these chats, we can do it in very, very, very broken Spanish. You at 40% of me at 2.
Yeah. It'd be all about apples and the leche we drank.
Exactly. I can tell you lots about like transport.
All the manzanas we want.
Oh my God. This has been like so much fun. It's been so, so, so wonderful to kind of just like peel away a couple of layers, you know, and like demystify sometimes. It's really nice for me to do that. And I really honestly am such an enormous admirer of you and what you do and how you do it. So thank you so much for making time to like chat to me and share your life with me.
Papa, it's been such a pleasure chatting with you and getting to know you a little bit. And I really look forward to seeing what comes next for you. And I hope one of those things is sitting on my terrace eating some spaghetti and meatballs.
I mean, that makes this even more worth it. So thank you so much for your time. It's been like an absolute joy.
Thanks for listening to Trade Secrets. You can stream All of I May Destroy You and Mayor of Easttown right now on HBO Max. Each episode of the Trade Secrets podcast features a different pair of creative pros from some of the most talked about content on HBO Max. And the conversations drop on a surprise schedule. So if you haven't already, definitely make sure you subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. We have some amazing duos coming up that you don't want to miss. So stay tuned. Trade Secrets is a production of HBO Max and Pineapple Street Studios. Beyondria July produces the show. Brianna Garrett is our associate producer. Our editor is Darby Maloney. Hannes Brown is our engineer. Gabrielle Lewis is our senior managing producer. Our executive producers are Barry Finkel, Jenna Weiss-Berman, and Max Linsky. To support the show, please follow, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts and tell a friend. And as Papa and Julianne said during this episode, remember, sometimes all you can do is show up and make room for magic to happen. Until next time,